Sort of like corn cobs, you know, in a way. It's like a row of corn would fall off. But you held one up, and it was an entire row.
Yeah, the way it works is their teeth would erupt, and they're out of sequence in development. So it's like this tooth would shed, and then another one a little bit further down the row, and another one down the row. So they wouldn't shed them all at once. They were just each tooth row would shed one out about every 50 to 80 days, but they were staggered a little bit. So they always had a grinding battery to work with.
Now, you gentlemen mentioned the Colville River. I stood on the huge banks, the western bank of that river last night in Google Earth. Maybe you can explain to our listeners exactly where it is, how far from the Beaufort Sea, where exactly the Prince Creek Formation is, which I looked on Macrostat as well. So I walked through it last night, but tell our radio listeners where this is, how you got there, and exactly in relation to Alaska.
And yeah, mention
too about the background of the Liskum bone bed, Greg. So explain it all, man.
Yeah, so back in the late 60s, an oil company was out there looking for oil in Alaska. Imagine that. And they came across along the Colville River. So the Colville River dumps into the Beaufort Sea or the Arctic Ocean. And about 25 miles from the Beaufort Sea there, they started finding some bones. And the oil company brought them back, and they thought they were woolly mammoth bones of all things. So something lived, you know, a million years ago to tens of thousands of years ago, which suggests maybe their search for oil was a little off in terms of time, because the formation there is actually 70 million years old. But anyway, a geologist was shown the fossils and said, those aren't woolly mammoth bones. Those are dinosaur bones. And so this caught the attention of the University of California, Berkeley in particular, and also the University of Alaska Museum of the North and in Fairbanks. And they basically teamed up and started doing expeditions up there. And so I saw some of those material when I was a graduate student at Berkeley, and I was very intrigued by, you know, Alaskan dinosaurs. It's crazy. What happened was Pat Druckenmiller, my research partner at the University of Alaska, he became the curator there, and I approached him about doing some research up there to try to figure out not just who's up there, but why are they up there? How are they up there? And so we've been working up there for over a decade now as part of the Arctic Paleontological Research Consortium. And we're basically just trying to figure out how dinosaurs lived under snowy conditions part of the year. How do they survive 4 to 5 months of complete polar darkness? Most of the trees were deciduous. There wasn't much plant matter in the winter. So it's a natural test of dinosaur physiology. So that's, you know, I'm a paleobiologist, and so we're trying to use this as a way to figure out, what kind of physiology these animals had, warm-blooded, cold-blooded, did they migrate, were they up there year-round, who lived with them, those kinds of questions.
Well, the question I have is that part of the landmass pretty much has stayed at 80 degrees. What's the latitude?
It's
up there?
It's 70, right? Yeah. 70 okay. Right now, but it was 80.
But it's pretty much stayed up there for most of the Earth's time, correct?
Yeah, at least through the Cretaceous. So it was 85 degrees north back then. So it was actually the continent was shifted a little bit more north. And
farther north.
But
so,
wouldn't it have been mostly tropical even in the winter?
No, it actually wasn't tropical then. It was kind of like Juneau, Alaska. And so it was not the kind of environment you expect a lot of reptiles. I mean, we don't go up to Juneau and look for crocodiles and that kind of thing. Yeah, no, it was a serious challenge, a natural test of dinosaur physiology. And that's what we're trying to, that's the nut we're trying to crack.
So, yeah, I remember walking on just the sheer volume of bones along the Colville River is pretty astonishing, really. But I like it to maybe more like Ketchikan, Alaska myself, Greg, but not Juneau. But
you had the great swings of darkness and light.
Yes, there's still
but it was
6 months of darkness up there. And,
yeah.
I worked in the book with Kirk Johnson, and, I did a lot of drawings based on what happened there. What explains the mass mortality? Why are there so many bones along the Colville River? What are your ideas on that? Because there's just hundreds, thousands of bones.
Well, first of all, what's the ecosystem back then?
Well, let's do both those.
Yeah, well, it was a floodplain, so we had the Brooks Range was just coming up, and so we had all these rivers coming down onto this huge floodplain, and that's where the dinosaurs lived, basically near the ancient seaway there, and With regard to the Liscombe bone bed, so Liscombe bone bed is made up almost entirely of an animal we name called a Grunelik, which is a duckbill dinosaur. And there's hundreds, if not thousands of them in, you know, just one big layer there. How they died in mass, we're not sure. It's possible they were trying to cross a river or something and they all drowned. We honestly just don't know.
I have a silly idea.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, thousands, tens of thousands migrated up there, just like the wildebeest or the caribou. Tens of thousands, and then it got dark and cold, and they all died.
That's kind of silly, Dave. But
they just gave up. As I always tell my students, it's never too late to give up.
Yeah, that's good to know.
But wait, what I'm seriously though. They obviously established millions of years of living in that place, or how do you know it wasn't a mass migration that happened one season and they got caught in the cold?
Pat and I just had a paper, and Pat and some of my colleagues, I should say, and we discovered perinatal remains up there of almost every dinosaur species.
Oh,
so
okay.
We have, and so a perinate is either an animal that's in the egg or just hatched out. And so we have tyrannosaurs, we have a horned dinosaur called Pachyrhinosaurus, little raptors, there's a big raptor up there, a troodon.
You have a whole ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly, and they're all nesting up there. And I did a study showing, looking at how long it took dinosaur eggs to incubate, and a small dinosaur's egg took about 3 months to hatch out. And a large dinosaur, like a duckbill dinosaur or a tyrannosaur, their eggs probably took about 4 to 5 months to hatch out.
Wow.
Basically, if you take that into account with the climatology up there, there's no way they would have hatched out and had time to run for Alberta for a warmer climate. So they had
right.
to, yeah, so they basically had to stick it out. I mean, they're kind of like moose or caribou today up there. They had to just stick it out. And so that's part of the mystery. The next question is, how did they do it?
Well, my question, too, is, you know, when I was up there, most of the bones that we were finding of a Grunelik were juveniles, and now your new findings with Pat and that other, that's another bone bed that you found up there. Would you call that, that's actually not part of the Liscombe bone bed. This is a separate bone bed. It's maybe the same age range, 70 million years-ish.
Yeah, so probably the most exciting discovery we made is most people had gone up there and they looked at the Liscombe bone bed. I mean, it's just so many bones, you can't miss it. But that's about all you get is a Grunelik and then occasional shed tyrannosaur teeth or troodon teeth that fed upon them. Not much information. And so we discovered a bed up on a cliffside that it's really hard to access. We rappel down to get down to it. And it's amazing. It's called OJ-saurus, after one of our colleagues we call OJ, who basically discovered it. And it's exciting because it has every species in it. It looks like someone took a zoo and ran it through a Cuisinart. There's just bones of everything in it. But it's really dangerous to access. And so that's the one we're picking at right now. But it's revealing a lot about who actually lived there on a grand scale.
Well, I remember I worried a lot about bears up there because there are brown bears and, you know, the grizzlies. And then there's also polar bears in the same area. But really, the thing you got to watch out for in the Colville River is the slumping riverside is what's going to get you. And I have a photograph of you that I took actually moments after you fell. A whole section of the river fell down and you went down with it and almost tumbled into the water. Of course, I took the picture first and then went to help you. But in the summertime, it's this slumping mud, basically.
But that's how the guy died, though. The guy who found the first fossil, he died the following year of a buried in a landslide, right?
You got to watch out for those overburdens. They will get you. And and Mr. Liscombe did die from an avalanche, I guess. Was that along the Colville?
I believe so.
I just read the wiki about that. This ecosystem, do you have a beginning date and an end date? Did it end with the end of the Cretaceous? And how long was it throughout the Maastrichtian? Or how long is this ecosystem up in the Arctic?
Yeah, so the dinosaurs are coming out of sediments about 70 million years, or aged at about 70 million years ago. The formation actually goes all the way to the KPG boundary, but we haven't found any dinosaurs at the time that the dinosaurs perished. But most of the stuff's about 70 million.
So five million years.
Yes.
You haven't found stuff. This is earlier than T-Rex. So the Tyrannosaur that's up there is Nanuxaurus. And the duckbill dinosaur is a Grunuluk. And actually, there's been pushback on whether or not a Grunuluk is a valid name. And even on Wikipedia, it says nullum dubium. Greg, where do you stand on that, man?
Well, we co-named it. So I think it's a valid taxon. So what they're ignoring is we actually had not just juvenile bones that we named it. We actually have some adult bones that show features that this is not the Edmontosaurus regalis, which lived at the same time in Alberta, although they're close relatives. I've got a paper that I presented at meetings, but I haven't published it yet, basically showing that this dinosaur only grew to about 20 feet in length, whereas Edmontosaurus regalis, that people think it is, grew to 55 feet in length. So this is a whole...
Stunted.
This is a much smaller species, so I don't have any doubt it's a valid taxon, and I think in the end that'll be shown. But scientists like to argue.
Yeah, they do, and that's how science progresses. And I would like to see Alaska get an official state dinosaur, and I think a Grunuluk is a perfect candidate.
Don't they have one? No. Wasn't it that that governor who ran for vice president a while back?
Yeah, well, there is that guy, but we do have an official state fossil. The official state fossil is the woolly mammoth, but we need a dinosaur. Don't you think so, Greg?
I thought the official state fossil was Ray Troll, but okay.
Hey! Thank you, Greg.
Oh, man.
Awesome.
That was a softball there, dude.
Okay. Hey, I want to move on to just some bite meters and crocodilians and T-Rexes.
Bitometer, yeah.
Bitometer. There's a photo of you sticking a bitometer in the very back of a crocodile on your Florida State University page.
It's a saltwater crocodile, 17. Yeah, it's
with no teeth. It is literally is a granny with no teeth. So did it try to gum you to death?
Well, actually, when crocs get older, they do start losing their teeth and don't get them back.
Yeah,
down here, they call them a gum bumper. It'll gum you to death. But
yeah.
The animals we tested had all their back teeth. That's what matters for our testing.
And was that up in Queensland where you did that?
It was up in Darwin, Australia. We tested the biggest crocodiles I've tested were 17-foot saltwater crocs. And the highest bite force we got was 3,700 pounds, which is literally the world's record for anything that's ever been measured directly. And it was scary. So that research is about understanding the working end of a crocodile is basically the mouth, as my dad used to say, the working end. So trying to figure out how crocodiles tick, but then we also use it to understand the evolution of crocodiles while they're so successful. And then carry it over to model how they generate their bite force is because the musculature of a crocodile is very similar to a dinosaur. So we use those data to estimate the bite force of T-Rex. And by reconstructing the musculature on a T-Rex using our data, we came up with a value of about 8,000 pounds of bite force.
Wow.
So it's like setting a couple pickup trucks on top of those jaws. So.
Wow.
In researching this episode, I learned a new word, extreme osteophagy. Is that correct? Did I say it right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the ability to crush bones like hyenas and wolves do. Now, you propose a T-Rex could do it as well. And I saw a documentary where someone had welded what looked like a steel T-Rex skull with steel T-Rex teeth and bones. And the question is, in this documentary, the guy was crushing, uncooked cow femur. So these are massive bones. And they were able to just literally break and crush them and splinter them. So the question is, how do we know that a T-Rex tooth would be as strong as these man-made steel teeth? I mean, the only fossils we have are 65 million years old. They'll crumble when you not crumble, but I've held T-Rex teeth. You don't want to drop one, is what I'm saying. Is there any sort of a comparative anatomy that you say, okay, well, a croc's tooth is this strong, so a T-Rex, while it was alive, had to be that strong?
Yeah, so one of my first papers was on T-Rex bite marks, and I studied a pelvis of a triceratops that was brought into the Museum of the Rockies by a Lutheran pastor named Ken Olson. He brought it in.
I saw that photo.
Yeah, and it's just got, it's 80 of these holes in it. It looked like Clifford the Big Red Dog had worked it over. Somebody had machine gunned it. And so he asked me what I thought it was, and I said, well, only two things could have done this, a crocodile or a T-Rex. And so I I took dental putty from, I went to my dentist and he gave me some dental putty because I want to copy some teeth. And I pushed it down into some of the holes and pulled it out, and they're exact replicas of T-Rex teeth.
Wow, that's cool.
So, really?
So it definitely could bite right through bone, no problem. My father did a study one time for a court defense in Yellowstone where someone had been killed by a bear. And back then they had steel coolers, you know, Stanley coolers. And that bear had torn that apart. So, I mean, they can bite through steel, too. I don't doubt the T-Rex could rip the hood off a car. No problem. Right.
So I wouldn't be safe in the car then. Oh, good to know. So is a T-Rex...
Especially if you're a lawyer.
Yeah, right. The lawyers always get it. So the crocodile bite force versus T-Rex bite force, which is stronger?
The highest bite forces in a crocodile we got is about 3,700 pounds, and okay. T-Rex is around 8,000 pounds.
Okay, all right. Just wanted to clarify that. That is incredible.
Yeah. You don't want to get bit by either of them is what my feeling would be. But
so where do you stand on the scavenger versus predator and versus opportunistic thing with T-Rex?
Well, so T-Rex did both. So we have cases where we have lots of duck-billed dinosaurs, bone beds, very much like the Liscombe, but also with Edmontosaurus, where, you know, lived with T-Rex. And clearly, you know, hundreds, thousands of these animals died in a drought or something. And then T-Rex scavenged them. We find tooth marks and shed teeth all the time from T-Rex. But recently, there's been some fossils of duck-billed dinosaurs that have bite marks in them from T-Rex. In fact, in one case, there's a tailbone of a Edmontosaurus that has a broken T-Rex teeth in it.
It's actually in it. Wow, yeah.
Yeah, and it healed, so it survived. So it definitely acted as a predator and a scavenger. So it did both, but that's not unusual. Vultures will actually kill small animals, and lions are more than happy to scavenge hyena kills and that kind of thing. So what is a predator? What is a scavenger? I designate it as, what is it? How does it get the majority of its meals? That's the way I look at it.
Well, it's an opportunist, really.
Yeah, and so some of the bite mark studies, basically once we discovered what tyrannosaur bite marks looked like, people started going around looking for, you know, who got bitten and that kind of thing. And the general profile seems to be, and also from, actually, I should back up, also from the fecal matter, we call coprolites, you could see what they ate as well, the bones and things. And what we see in most tyrannosaur fecal matter and also most of the bite mark instances are younger animals getting bitten. That's what a predator does. A scavenger is going to eat anything it finds that's dead, but there seems to be they seem to have a propensity to go after younger, more naive animals. So I personally think T-Rex was probably a predator, but it's kind of a quantitative thing. It's not an easy question to get at.
Well, that's, being the son of a bear biologist, you must know that bears go after the young ones and the old ones too, but the really old ones. So
most predators will go after what's easy. Why take the risk of hurting yourself when you can take out the young, naive individuals in the herd versus trying to take on, say, a full-grown triceratops or something? I don't doubt that occurred once in a while, but this is just what predators do. So anyway, I personally think T-Rex was probably more of a predator than a scavenger. But, you know, it's just a really, you know, you're asking a lot of us. It's forensic science. And we're doing it, you know, 65 million years ago.
It's really cool.
Not much to work with.
Which leads me to wonder, now, did you figure out the bite force of a hadrosaur? I mean, we don't really care, but, you know, we like the idea of crunching bone, but has this data been extrapolated with a hadrosaur?
No, we haven't done that with herbivores like that. So hadrosaurs bit down and they kind of ground their tooth to the sides. Like, it's the same with like horses. It's like, I don't really know what the bite force of a horse is. We can estimate it and that kind of thing. But they're not just biting down, they're grinding sideways. There's more to it. It's a more dynamic motion. Right. A tyrannosaur biting is more like a pair of scissors. It's just, you know, just closing down on something. And same with crocodiles. It's easy to measure. It's a little hard. It's a little harder to quantify or make sense out of what a herbivore is doing.
Sure.
When it's grinding.
I didn't think about a cow chewing its cud. And
yeah, but
side to side motion.
We had Karen Chin on a couple episodes ago, and she was talking about some of the work she's done with the coprolites with hadrosaurs. And she had found a lot of tree material actually in the coprolites that they were...
And crabs. And they were eating crabs.
But also, I mean, hadrosaurs could eat a tree or pine cones, or they ate a lot of really rough stuff.
Well,
or
she,
you're shaking
she
your head.
Said rotting. It was rotting.
It was trees. Rotting trees, yes. But what did those herds of herbivores, what did the duckbills eat, Greg?
Well, as near as we can tell, they just ate about any kind of plant matter they could find. We have some evidence from stomach contents and fecal matter, some of Karen's wonderful work, showing them eating tree bark and tree matter, conifer needles. I mean, you name it, they could eat it. And, with that pulverizing dentition, I don't think there was too many plants that they couldn't, make use of. So I would just say just about anything green they ate, and also, I guess, some crabs or something. So.
You've done a whole lot of documentaries over the years, and you're doing one now that we can't really talk too much about, but they'll be coming out soon. But you were approached via Super Croc, and I know that our friend Gary Staub actually sculpted that beast, and there was kind of a turning point for you there when they were the ones that somehow suggested maybe the Bite Force thing would be cool to film?
Yeah, what happened was I was a brand new professor, and I just got here at Florida State, and they called me up and they said, we're doing this documentary on this incredible crocodile that Paul Cirino from University of Chicago had found. And they had about 30 minutes of footage in the field, of them digging it up, then some footage of Gary building this incredible model of it. But they needed, back then they did 2-hour documentaries. This is a National Geographic special. And so they needed some more footage. And so they'd seen I'd estimated the bite forces of T-Rex from bite marks, working with some engineers at Stanford. And so they asked me if I could do that with a Super Croc. And I said, well, no, I don't have any bite marks. And I said, I know how to do it though. And they said, oh, well, how do you do it? And I said, well, if we test the bite forces of all the living crocodiles, and we can scale that up to what the Super Croc could do. And they said, oh, that's fantastic. Will you do it? And I said, no. And I go, why not? I go, well, I don't have any money to do it. It's like, yeah, it's just an idea I have. And, of course, they said, oh, well, we have grants. Of course, I knew that. I go, oh, really?
Really?
I mean, I just said, look, the dean doesn't want me doing anything that's not bringing him money. And so what happened was they go, we'll send you a grant application. Could you fill it out tonight? And I said, sure. So I filled it out. I sent it back to them. And literally one day later, they go, hey, congratulations, you got your grant. And so it was the easiest grant I ever got. And the dean was happy because I was bringing him money and it was going to be on TV. And so they basically funded the development of the Bite Force meter. So I worked with some engineers that I'd worked with at Stanford and Cornell and whatnot. And also the company that makes the force transducers. And we came up with a design, and I think we had to throw this together really quick and to get ready for their film. And, a month later, here I am testing these things, not even knowing what was going to happen. I mean, people don't stick things like that in the mouth of a crocodile very often, or an alligator.
Did you invent or develop the bite meter?
Or
improve upon it?
Together, a bunch of engineers and myself worked on designing it. Frankly, the first day I did it was terrifying because, I go up to an 11-foot alligator and, we pull it out of its pan. This is at the St. Augustine Alligator Farm in St. Augustine, Florida. St. Augustine Alligator Farm Zoological Park, they call themselves now. They have every species. So I approached them and they were okay with me testing them. And I remember going up to the 11-foot alligator, the first time I tested a big animal. I didn't know what was going to happen. It was terrifying. I was young and stupid back then. But, I literally, as I was putting it in, I was thinking, it's going to hit that thing. I'm going to go flying away like Wile E. Coyote or something. Who knows what's going to happen here? Fortunately, it worked. And so we were able to test every species of crocodilian and got some wonderful data. It was
I'm looking at a graph, an image that we're going to put on the website. It's the press release for this, and it's literally a bite force on one side and body mass on the other. And it's got the skull of every crocodile, gharial, alligators, caimans, all the way on the right-hand side is the giant, what is it, Sarcosuchus. Yeah, and a picture of a man, a little tiny man next to it,
that's
with a bite force of what looks to be 23,000 pounds per square inch of this Sarcosuchus.
So that'd be like, so that's what we estimated for them, and it'd be like taking a semi-tractor, you know, a Mack truck, take the front end of it, and dropping that on those jaws. That's how much force it was generating.
Wow.
And also the tooth pressures we figured out from that study, too. So crocodiles, big crocodiles, and T-Rex generated.
What's a mugger? I never heard of that. A mugger?
A mugger, yeah.
What's a mugger? What is that? It's a crocodile or a gharial?
It's a man-eating crocodile from Indonesia or from India.
A mugger. Wow, I like the name.
So it's a salty then?
No, it's more of a freshwater kind of creature.
Right, right.
Well, I'm curious, Greg. You say there's a quote from you here from somewhere on the internet. I refer to our largest bite force meter as an expensive $11,000 bathroom scale, since it mimics the design of the best bathroom scales. How do you actually stick something like a bathroom scale into a crocodile's mouth and get them? I mean, is it baited, or do you like, is the croc restrained and you stick something near it?
Well, first of all, one of your questions, we don't bait them. I'm the bait. That works just fine. So what we do, we're working in a zoo or even with wild animals. We catch them, we throw a noose around them and pull them out, and basically drag them up onto shore and secure them, hold them down, and they're mad as a motor scooter at this point. And so then you basically just we come up, and you come in real low, and you put the bite meter on their teeth, and they'll slam it. They can't see the meter coming in. They see me coming in, but if you keep it low, they can't, when they're on land like that, they can't see it coming. And as soon as it touches their jaws, it's just a reflex, and they just explode.
But you do the back of the mouth, not the front, right?
Yeah, so
where the molars would be if there were molars on a croc.
Yeah, so the back teeth are called molariform teeth, and those are the crushing teeth. The fulcrum, the closer you get to a fulcrum, the jaw joint is the highest bite,
right.
Highest force. So we can estimate the force all the way around the jaw. I just need it taken at some point. We always do it at the back of the jaw.
Oh, wow.
It's exciting.
And with all of these crocs, did you even get close to getting bit or in danger?
I've almost lost an arm or leg here and there. That's a fact. But I have been bitten, but not by a big one.
Huh.
Right.
So when they bite down, are they clamping down and they don't let go, or is it a snap?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. What they do is they hammer it. So let's say we do an 11-foot alligator. It'll hit that thing at about with 2,000 pounds of force, literally a ton. And what they'll do is they'll hold onto it, and they'll lighten up their force. We have computers hooked up onto this, and they'll lighten up their force to about 10% of that. So they're holding it about 200 pounds. And if you move the meter, they'll hit it again, like from a, like even in a clinch, and it'll go right back to 2,000. And they'll do that for like 20 minutes. And so what we figured out is that's probably mimicking how they, basically how they feed. So if an alligator gets a hold of a deer, it has to have a lot of force. It has to have hundreds of thousands of pounds of tooth pressure to puncture the hide. They basically they secure the animal, and they try to drag it into the water and drown it. Now, once they've done their initial bite, that puncture, they hold it at about 10%, but if the animal struggles, they'll hit it again and reassert themselves. And so I think it's just mimicking their actual, the way they actually feed in the wild.
Wow.
And then
that's grim. I'm just, oh man.
Yeah. And so my graduate student, Paul Genak, he's at Oklahoma State University. And he modeled he looked at the musculature on alligators and crocs, and he basically showed that they have dark muscle and white muscle, kind of like
a turkey,
like a turkey's leg muscles are dark, and then you have these white muscles, and basically
that's based on function.
Yeah, exactly. And so the darker muscles, they can, they've got excellent vascularization and whatnot, and so they can they basically can use those muscles to hold for a long time. Most of the muscles in an alligator or a crocodile are the white muscles. They're just made for explosive movements, but they use that 10% to just hold. And so it's really neat. We call it muscle gearing. So finding out what the different muscle types do.
And would you extrapolate that to a T-Rex jaw and its musculature?
We don't think so. T-Rex probably didn't do this holding thing. So the studies I've done on their bite marks show it's called puncture and pull feeding. So they bite very deeply into flesh and bone, and then they pull straight back and cut it out, pulverizing bone and everything when they did it. And so it's kind of a hit and run strategy. It's more like what a Komodo dragon would do or a white shark. They don't hold on. They just hit and run.
So take a chunk of cheese and bite into it and pull it out.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, rip and tear, but. Maybe a T-Rex. I'm just imagining the big sort of dark meat section on a T-Rex. Maybe they were.
You mean for Thanksgiving?
Yes, for Thanksgiving. But I want that thigh muscle bit. But the would they hold on to their predator, their prey with their feet, with their legs? Those useless little arms do nothing. But with their feet,
yeah, I think they would. A lot of predatory birds do that. They'll pin down their prey with their feet, and then they'll just rip at it and kill it. They'll do that with smaller prey. I think when a tyrannosaur took on a very large prey item like a duck-billed dinosaur, that's just a hit and run strategy. They're just trying to create a gaping wound and hope the animal bleeds to death, and that's kind of what we're seeing. I think anything small just got consumed in its entirety. We're not going to find a record of it anyway.
Wow. I'm loving this gruesome talk.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of good sound effects in this one, I think.
Yeah. Ray, do you want to ask your question?
What question is that, Dave? Greg, if you could time travel, if you could go back into the past, you can only go back, not forward. What epic epoch, what favorite paleo period would you go back to? What would you time travel back to, and what would you want to see, sir?
I get asked that a lot. I would I'd take my time machine, I'd probably go back and put all my money on Secretariat to win by 26 furlongs, and then I get more.
Okay, you do horse race.
Let's go back.
I take all that money and get an even better time machine, and then I'd go. I would love to. I guess I'd like to go back to the Cretaceous, late Cretaceous. Maybe just before the asteroid impact and all that kind of thing. I think, study the animals, see what they're really doing, and, test our theories, and then maybe see what happened afterward, I guess. So somewhere around there.
Would you be bold enough to try a bite meter on an actual T-Rex?
That's what grad students are for.
I was going to say, did you lose any grad students on the crocodile testing? But... Anyways, well, thanks. That's cool, man. Yeah, time traveling back. I think David has a profound question for you, Greg. So get ready.
Yeah. So now, as a comedian, I receive my job approval instantly. So if the audience is laughing or laughing hard, I know I'm performing at my best. Now, if I'm receiving chuckles or groans or worse, crickets, right, I know I need to up my game right then and there on the spot. Now, my job is one of the few occupations where job approval is instant. For a scientist, the hallmark of job approval is being peer-reviewed, and it's the way science has its own checks and balances. So you have a plethora of papers with your name. Now, can you go through the process, how you come up with a topic, the length of time it takes to author it, and what the submission process is all the way to publication? In 6 seconds or less.
What I do is I try to look for things that I can learn from bones and teeth, and I try to look for something I can learn about an animal's feeding, something about its biology, whatever, using what materials I have, and then I try to prove it in living animal that if you did this, you could actually derive that answer.
For example, give us a topic.
For instance, determining. The bite forces, for instance. If we can model these muscles, I can predict the bite force, and therefore, in theory, I could carry it over to a dinosaur. So that's part of it. Usually our studies take about, I don't know, sometimes 8 or 10 years before we finally get the answer.
Really?
And what's really crazy is when you make a scientific discovery, you're the first person on the planet to ever know that piece of information. And, of course, you're excited about it. And what do? You immediately run next door and tell your neighbor. No, the whole world knows. then you submit it for peer review and hope that the rest of the world accepts it and it's a slow process. It's not like sports where, you know, like a heavyweight boxer goes in and they know on that date when they're going in whether they're going to be champ or not. They are or they're not. In our business.
But when you say peer reviewed, does that mean five scientists say thumbs up or one scientist says thumbs up?
Yeah, it's usually between three and five reviewers, people that weren't part of the project, obviously, and are not your colleagues or friends.
Right.
And then
right.
the editor also has a say on it, too. You know, sometimes it doesn't work out, but I've had pretty good luck with some of my papers and people seem excited about it. And then after that, the fun part is doing what we're doing right now is just, I'm a teacher. I want to teach the scientific method to the masses, and dinosaurs are our children's first introduction to science. And so I see it as a very useful vehicle to teach the scientific method to people. Now, whether they become a scientist or not, it doesn't matter. The point is, when someone tells you something, ask for the data in support of it. That's just good life skills, no matter what you go into, be it business or science. And so I try to, and so the fun part is once you, particularly in dinosaurs, you know, get a lot of attention. So it's a great, we have a lot more opportunity to talk to the public about science and how we do things. I just love that. So this is the fun part. I find from teaching, I get more, I would not want to be a pure researcher. I want to be a teacher.
Well, it's no fun.
Yeah.
It's boring.
Yeah, but when I teach, I look into the eyes of some of these, you know, being a kid or you know, a college student or whatever, see them getting excited about what I'm talking about, and it reminds me how I got here. It's like, hey, I used to be excited about this too. It kind of energizes me and kind of keeps me going.
Yeah, I've heard that some of your lectures are sort of like rock concerts, man. Sort of like the Rolling Stones, and Greg's up there with the headphones. You have 1,000 students and you're working the crowd. But one of the things that you get, too, as a professor, you've been at Florida State University for many years now, you get the old instant feedback with the rate my professor thing, too. So I'm imagining that you have turned a lot of kids, a lot of younger people onto the wonders of paleontology. And I do really admire what you've done. You do a lot of work with kids, too. You go out. Talk to elementary schools as well, Greg?
Paying it forward.
Yeah.
All the time. Yeah. That's actually the most rewarding things I've ever done has been going out to talk to kids. And a few years ago, I talked up in Birmingham, Alabama, and I was talking to a bunch of children that had cancer. And it was just to see them smile for a minute. It was just brought tears to my eyes. Like right now, I'm kind of crying thinking about it. And that was probably the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life. And I was just happy that I was able to get them to, you know, bring some happiness to some really sad kids. Cool. Dinosaurs.
That's brilliant. Well, this has been great. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, I was also going to just add that on the peer-reviewed thing, it's cool to try to get the general public to understand the scientific process and what happens when you publish a paper. And one of the things is that the peer review, you don't know the people that are reviewing your paper, right? They're supposed to be kept kind of hush-hush.
So usually people don't sign the review, so you don't know who it was. Sometimes you can roughly figure it out. But it's blind review.
That's great. It's checks and balances. It's brilliant.
Hey, Greg, man, it was great having you on the show. It's so good to see you after all these years. I hope to get back in the field someday with you before I have to.
I want to go to the Colville
River. Yeah, the Colville River, and I want to do it before I have to use a walker to get down to the riverside. But, hey, man, it's great hanging again. Looking forward to your next paper.
Yeah, Ray, it's really great seeing you, too. And we'll run into each other again, I hope, and hopefully out in the field. But and David, thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful. And
well, thank you. It's been brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
Over and out.
Goodbye.
Well, that was fun, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I want to go to the Colville River up there in Alaska. You know, if you go and Google Earth it, you can see it in 3D. Those bluffs are massive that fall into the river.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's a pretty incredible stretch of Cretaceous stuff that's, just from 70 million years ago, but there's so much to find up there, but it's so very, very hard to get to it. You can't just drive there, Dave. You got to know somebody.
So what did you take, a plane from Barrow and then land on some strip out there?
Well, we drove up the Hall Road, all the way up the Hall Road, which is the road that goes to Prudhoe Bay.
Which is about 50 miles to the west.
Yeah.
East, 50 miles to the east.
You drive up to about, there's a couple of air services. You drive up there, and then you park your car, and then you get in a very small airplane.
But you drive from Barrow, you mean, or are you from Fairbanks?
No, we drove from Fairbanks all the way up.
Oh, yeah. Across the Brooks Range.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a great...
That must be amazing.
It's all in the Fossil Coastline book, which I know you've read.
Ray, I've read all your books, and I've forgotten them all.
I guess,
all as
apparently,
well.
You have, Dave. But that's all right. I still
because
like
can
it.
Can I be honest? I look at the pictures.
Well, that's all right.
I love your artwork.
Anyways,
your pictures.
We took the minivan up there, and you drive up to a place... We went to a small little airstrip up there and then flew in to the Colville River. And you land on a gravel bar.
On the river.
On the river. And then from there, it's inflatables and that kind of thing. And it's quite a production. Right. And Pat.
So it's not a, it's like a 30-minute flight then. It's really, it's a short flight from.
It was about an hour flying over.
Really?
Yeah, it's quite a ways.
100 miles, wow.
And then land on that gravel strip, and Pat Druckenmiller and Greg Erickson have been going up there for more than a decade. I went with them many years ago.
How long did you stay there?
We were there for, I think, about 6 days on the gravel bar.
Oh, so a whole camping out, yeah. And you had to bring your food. And did you see any bears? Or
no, there were lots of bear footprints all over the place, but...
Right.
They warned us not to bring too much, beverages, because that really weighs things down, that we would actually drink the river water. We'd process it and kind of put it through filters.
Right.
But we found so much stuff. It was incredible.
Well, I went camping with some novices up in the Redwoods up in California. And when the guy says, there's bears up there. I said, yeah, I know. My friend says, what? Bears? Well, how do we keep the bears away? And the guy says, well... Make sure that right before you get into your sleeping bag, you rub yourself with bacon grease and honey. And they went, oh, thank you so much. And I went, guys, did you hear what he just said?
they were not paying attention. Yeah, well, bears.
They were not paying attention.
My wife, Michelle, we saw a bear and two cubs, mama bear and two cubs, came just strolling up the driveway the other day and walked right across the, the porch.
Well, you train them to get your mail.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a good. So yeah, no, we live in bear country, but yeah, Greg Erickson flies all the way from Florida State University all the way up to Alaska. Wow. Pretty much every summer, and goes out there with the University of Alaska Fairbanks crew, and they continue to publish cool stuff. And the whole thing about the nesting baby dinosaurs—that's a paper that came out this year.
That is so
cool. Yeah, it's cool.
Well, look, I really want to go do some more field work, and hopefully next year when maybe hopefully life will get back to normal. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about 2022, mm-hmm. That's next year. Mm-hmm. We're still in 2021, and that would be wild. I miss the far north of Alaska. It really is a magical place, isn't it? I mean, when you go really high latitude, anywhere on the planet.
Yeah, the thing about the Colville, there's not a tree to be seen, but that Arctic light, there's nothing else like it.
Yeah.
And you have the eternal
As Barry daylight. Lopez said, it's rarefied air.
Is it? All right. Hey, well, on that note, David, I'm going to sign off for beautiful Ketchikan, Alaska by the sea. And where it's starting to rain again.
Well, I'm going to sign off from Ojai, California, where our reservoir is down to 20% and no sign of any water anywhere.
Mm. Let's bioengineer something, work something out. I'll ship you some water.
All right, and I'll seed the clouds.
Thanks. All right.
See you,
man.
Thanks for being a paleo nerd. Help us spread the word of science. Rate us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can even email your questions and comments to nerds@paleonerds.com. Did you know each episode is paired with pictures and links? Check out paleonerds.com for photographic evidence that everyone here has been a paleo nerd for a long, long time.
I'm a paleo nerd. I'm a paleo nerd. I'm a paleo nerd. I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd.
closer to you. Oh, honey, Houston. Houston means the last day of the tour and we're through. Well, honey, you and God in heaven above know I love what I do for a living, I do. Oh, but Houston, Houston means that I'm one day closer to you. Yeah, singing at the world's biggest rodeo show was a great time for me and the guys. Oh, but when I'm away from you, honey, time always never flies. And sleeping all alone at that holiday hotel show makes a cowboy blue. But here I am in Houston and I'm one day closer to you. Houston, Houston means that I'm one day closer to you. Oh, honey, Houston, Houston means the last day of the tour is through. Well, honey, you and God in heaven above know I love what I do for a living, I do. Oh, but Houston, Houston means that I'm one day closer to you. Yeah, Houston, Houston means that I'm one day closer to you. Oh, honey, Houston, Houston means the last day of the tour is through. What I do for a living, I do. Oh, but Houston, Houston means that I'm one day closer to you. Yeah, honey, Houston, Houston means that I'm one day closer to you. As I travel o'er this world, just to soothe my roving mind, tender messages I get from a dear one left behind. They were filled with sweetest words that so touched me when I heard. Never, never can I forget, these are some things that she said. It's sweet to be remembered on a bridal. is sweet to be remembered by a dear one far away. Is sweet to be remembered, remembered, remembered. Is sweet to be remembered when you are far away.
If you want a good gal to stay around, you gotta treat her nice and kind. If you do her wrong, she'll leave this town and you'll almost lose your mind. And you'll be moaning, moaning the blues. Oh, baby, 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 honey, baby, please come home. Your daddy is lonesome and all I do is moan. I promise you, baby, that I'll be good and I'll never be bad no more. I'm sitting here waiting for you right now to walk through that front door. Then I'll stop moaning, moaning the blues.
Holler. We were poor, but we had love. That's the one thing that Daddy made sure of. He shoveled coal to make a poor man's dollar. My Daddy worked all night in the Van Leer coal mines. All day long. Mommy rocked the babies at night and read the Bible by the coal oil light. And everything would start all over come break of morn. Daddy loved and raised their kids on a miner's pay. Mommy scrubbed our clothes on a washboard every day. Why, I've seen her fingers bleed to complain there was no need. She'd smile in mommy's understanding way. In the summertime we didn't have shoes to wear, but in the wintertime we'd all get a brand new pair. From a mill order catalog, money made selling a hog, Daddy always managed to get the money somewhere. Yeah, I'm proud to be a coal miner's daughter. I remember well the well where I drew water. The work we done was hard. At night we'd sleep 'cause we were taught. Never thought of ever leaving, but your holler. Well, a lot of things have changed since way back then, and it's so good to be back home again. Not much left but the floor, nothing lives here anymore except the memories of.
Dallas, I'll be coming home. It won't be very long. Don't let them close your roads till I get back. My daddy thinks I'm gone for good, but mama, she knows better. Dallas, I'll be coming home to you. You couldn't understand that night why I packed up and left you. You knew I wouldn't find it way out here. These city lights of Tulsa make me lonesome for you, Dallas. Dallas, I'll be coming home.